engines. Whatever its final destination was, it hadn't yet made planetfall or even entered Atmo. The artificial gravity was still on, and artificial gravity felt different from real gravity. On world, your weight distribution was more even, and there wasn't that vague dizziness which dogged you all the time when you were shipboard and which you never quite got accustomed to, no matter how good your space legs were.
"It's so's you can't go sharing any information about us," Phillips said.
"Furthest thing from my mind," Mal said. "I swear by your uniquely scarred face, which would make it easy to describe you to the authorities and them to catch you, that I will never breathe a word to anyone about you." He shut his eyes tightly and braced himself, anticipating that his witticism would annoy the irritable Phillips, who was in a perfect position to kick him in the teeth.
"You really do love to hear yourself talk, don't you?" Phillips said. "Bet you talk, talk, talk in front of a mirror and always crack yourself up. Got some news for you, traitor. Being clever and using big words ain't gonna save your backside this time." "Please don't hate me for my vocabulary," Mal said.
"Shut up," the man snarled. Then he bent down and drew the bag over Mal's head, cinching the draw cord around his neck so he couldn't shake it off. There was no escaping the hood's aroma, or the fact that his captor was just inches away. For a split second, Mal debated whether to spring up and lunge for him in the hope of taking him down. But while he was effectively blind and his hands were tied, he knew it would be futile. He'd doubtless end up getting hurt for his trouble. Something scraped against the ropes that held his ankles pinned together, and his legs were suddenly free. Phillips grabbed him under the arm and said, "Stand." He yanked hard, nearly dislocating Mal's shoulder, but barely budging him from the deck.
"I would, except my feet are asleep," Mal said.
It was the god's honest truth. Phillips yanked him up anyway. Caterpillars by the billions skittered up his legs and his knees buckled. Phillips grunted and pushed him forward. Mal floated over the ground as Phillips alternately shunted and guided him from behind.
"We're at the combing," the man said. "Lift your feet up."
Mal couldn't feel a thing, but did his best to comply, raising his leg to step over the lip in the floor that was part of the hatchway and bulkhead wall. On seagoing vessels, the combing kept the ocean out if it had occasion to spill across the main deck and into the ship. On spaceships, it could halt the path of a fire or the vacuum of space by creating a seal with the hatch. Again, he contemplated and discounted some kind of escape attempt. What if he feigned falling over, dragging Phillips to the floor with him? Then, while Phillips was sprawled off balance, he could scissor his legs around the guy's neck and try to choke him out. As long as the sack was on his head and his hands remained tied behind his back, however, Mal stood about as much chance of pulling off this feat as a one-legged man stood of winning an ass-kicking contest.
"Where are we going?" he asked.
"You'll find out soon enough," Phillips said. "Now, stop here and hold still."
Mal heard footfalls thudding on the deck plates, faint at first, then growing gradually louder and louder. Sounded like 4 or 5 sets.
"Lao Tianye, what in heck do you still have a hood on him for?" someone new demanded.
From the edge the voice carried, Mal figured this to be someone in charge, Phillips' superior at least.
"So's he can't tell no one anything about us," Phillips said.
Mal refrained from pointing out that he already knew Phillips' name and could identify him. What Phillips hadn't reasoned through couldn't hurt him.
"Don't concern yourself with that," someone new snapped. "He won't be telling anyone about anything, unless ghosts can gossip."
"Well, that does not sound hopeful," Mal thought.
"No, sir, not one bit hopeful."
"Well, I'm leaving it on anyways," Phillips shot back. "It makes him easier to handle."
"Actually, not as much as you might think," Mal ventured. "My feet are asleep and I'm swaying a bit. Difficult to keep my balance. Could go down in a heap any second."
"Yeah," someone new said. "We were told you were tricky, Reynolds. The sort of guy you need to watch out for, in case of shenanigans."
"Shenanigans? Me?" Mal said.
"What lying no good polecat told you that? I'm surprised you haven't pieced it together yet."
Mal thought for a second, then said,
"Just for the sake of clarity, and of putting all cards on the table, let me ask. Did I do something to piss off Hunter Covington?"
because I've only met the fellow the once, and all I thought he wanted was to hire me for a job, and now I'm a missing person and a prisoner, and if this is some kind of test of loyalty or personal grit, I would like to think by now I've surely passed it.
Just shut up, said someone new. You're right, Donovan. Keep the damn bag over his head. It muffles the sound of that voice.
Oh, ha, ha, Mal thought. Beads of sweat rolled down his forehead, stinging his eyes and the cuts and bruises he realized he had around his mouth. He ran his tongue over his teeth. All still there. Who had he pissed off this bad? His ex-wife and former partner in thievery, Yosef Bridge? Niska? Both were still at large as far as he knew, and either would have been capable of chicanery like this. But it didn't feel like their handiwork to him. What about that ornery old horse thief, Patience? Nah, she wouldn't bother with leaving Whitefall, the moon she was currently bullying, and anyway, by now she would have already shot him several times. She was tetchy that way. Mal tried again. If there's something I can do to put this right. His olive branch was rewarded with a punch on the jaw that sent him reeling. He would have collapsed except that one of his tormentors, he had no idea which, grabbed his shoulder, twisted him around, and slammed him headfirst into a wall. For the briefest instant, Mal saw stars, which actually was no improvement over seeing nothing. No more talking, Philip said, or I'll cut out your tongue. Mal wondered why a gag wouldn't be the rational first choice, but fell silent. That's better, Philip said. See what I've been putting up with the whole way here? You have so not, Mal thought indignantly. I've been unconscious most of the time. Okay, enough of this, someone new said. Prepare for landing. Sit down, Philip said to Mal, and keep your mouth shut. Mal crossed his ankles and sank to the deck unsteadily. Though thick-headed, with his trapped hands now joining his feet in the land of numb, he began playing and replaying everything that had occurred since first contact with Hunter Covington. Yesterday, if more time than that had not elapsed, had been Alliance Day, and judging by the ruckus that had come from Taggart's during his own confrontation with Covington, he was confident Jane and Zoe had enjoyed a big juicy bar fight with a side order of fisticuffs. He hoped his two crewmates had left the bar safe and sound, and were, at that very moment, zeroing in on where he was and figuring out how to retrieve him from whoever had captured him. But there was also the less delightful possibility that they'd followed him out of the bar and gotten themselves taken too, or worse, left for dead in some Persephone back alley. If the crew of Serenity were coming to save him, that meant they'd put the delivery of the crates on the back burner, a decision that, while good for him, could very well undermine business deals for the foreseeable future. After Niska, they needed to cement their reputation for reliable and on-time service. Their new motto, smuggling be us or some such. The roar of retro thrusters shut off his line of thought. The shuttle was breaking atmo at a seriously flawed angle. The too steep re-entry made Mal's cheeks go saggy and flutter wildly against his clenched teeth. Buffeting. Buffeting. He hoped to blue blazes someone had taken the time to check the heat shield before they started the descent. One crack could turn to 2, and 2 to 10, and before you knew it, you were a Goram meteor. More buffeting. Harder. It was like being trapped inside a cocktail shaker without the booze. Then the vibrations stopped, and the welcome pull of real gravity replaced the ship's artificial. Mal's ears popped. He still had to pee, and thanks to the sudden appearance of normal grav, with considerable more urgency. The vessel settled down on the ground with a resounding crunch and the engines cut out. Then he was pulled brusquely to his feet, maybe by Phillips, maybe by someone new. He flexed his hands over and over, trying without much luck to bring the feeling back into his fingers. There were other people around him, aside from Phillips and someone new. From the combined body warmth and parts per million a sweat odor, he knew he was well and completely surrounded, as though being escorted by an honor guard. As they dragged him off, he couldn't come up with a single stratagem that could turn the tables and save his life. He was plumb out of imaginary heroics. After a heap of clanging boot soles on metal deck plates, the path they were taking angled downward. He felt a rush of cool air and realized he was being herded off a gangplank. Then the footing under him got soft. Sand or fine soil, maybe.
Earthy odors penetrated the chicken feed stink of the burlap sack. Mud. Dirt. Rock. Down they walked, or rather, his escorts walked, and Mal stumbled. After a bit, their breathing and grunts of effort suddenly got louder, and their footsteps began to echo. Mal's right shoulder scraped something hard and sharp like chiseled rock. The air was noticeably damper and clammier, and they were traveling on a shallow downward incline. He rationalized that they were taking him into a cavern or a tunnel. Something sizzled on the right side of his body, and he sensed a rush of heat, which quickly passed. He smelled burning rags and oil, a torch most likely, stuck in the wall in a sconce. The angle of their descent grew steeper, and it became even more of a challenge not to trip and fall. Mal didn't want to give these guys any excuse to hit him. They were already a bit too fond of the exercise, and he figured he might need his every speck of brains later. Without warning, the group stopped. "That him?" someone Double Knew asked. The question echoed into the distance. "That him? Him? Him?" "Who else might it be?" Mal wondered. A feeble hope fluttered in his throat that the kidnappers had somehow grabbed the wrong person outside Taggart's, confused one Mal Reynolds with another of similar features and identical moniker. And then the hood was yanked off Mal's head. Moldy subterranean air hit his face. Torches, dozens of them, flickered against the gloom of dark rock walls and ceiling. The man glaring at him from arm's length looked familiar to Mal. He had biggish ears, smallish eyes, and a decidedly crooked nose. It was the singular beak that tapped at Mal's memory. There was no forgetting that narrow blade with the sudden dogleg to the right, or the downright marvel that the two holes at the drippy end hadn't by force of momentum ended up somewhere on his opposing cheek. That busted to hell nose had fought beside Mal's own nose in the war. Mal was sure of it. He and the other man had taken on the alliance, nose to nose, as it were. The man said nothing, only watched him with a calculation in his eyes. The rows of torches on the walls hissed and sputtered and gave off ribbons of black smoke. "Help me out here," Mal said. "I know you, right?" "You'll get it," the man assured him. "Just take your time." After a few seconds, it all came rushing back. "Deacons," Mal said, triumph and relief flooding his voice. It was Stuart Deacons, late of the so-called Balls and Bayonets Brigade. For 2 years, that at the time seemed like 112, Stu Deacons had been a ground pounder under Sergeant Malcolm Reynolds' command. Mal had half-carried, half-dragged the wounded man to safety in a firefight during the new Casimir offensive, running a gauntlet of Alliance gunfire. He was glad to find his soldier still alive and, hopefully, on scene to set straight whatever terrible misunderstanding had arisen. "Deacons, Stu, it's me, Malcolm Reynolds, Sergeant Reynolds, as was." "Yeah, Sarge, I know who you are," Stu Deacons said, "and who you were." With that, he dipped a shoulder and swung hard for Mal's gut. The punch seemed to come at Mal in slow motion, and Mal tensed to absorb the blow. Surprise more than pain doubled him over, but the impact still knocked the wind out of him. As he struggled to catch his breath, Mal looked up at Deacons in disbelief. Before he could speak, the men surrounding him caught him under the arms and steered him onward. Mal looked back to see Deacons spitting on the very ground where he had just stood. That utterly dumbfounded him. "I saved his life. That's not something normally makes a man hit you, then hawk and spit in the dirt. Not unless the etiquette for gratitude has changed some since the war." His captors led him on down a tunnel hewn from virgin rock. There were cavities in the walls and ceiling that marked where timber braces had at one time provided support. An old mine of some sort, then. The tunnel split in two after a ways, and his escorts shoved him down the right-hand fork. After a bit more walking, the rock corridor ended, opening onto a cavern whose floor was 20 feet lower. When Mal and his captors stepped to the edge, they were met by a chorus of shouts from below. Lit by torches and oil drum fires, a group of 40 or so people stared up at them. Even in the flickering light, he could see the men and women all wore the traditional independent outerwear, a knee-length coat of brown suede. It made his heart swell to see folks thus decked out, honoring the side for which he'd fought and bled, and would do again if given the opportunity. It wasn't a costume party. They all looked to be roughly his age, certainly of a vintage that he could have served with. Veterans of the war. He thought he recognized a few of the faces. There was Panda Alcatraz with the wine-colored birthmarks around his eyes, and that guy Lucas, the sly bastard who had traded the now-deceased Tracy Smith a can of beans for what turned out to be the verse's bluntest bayonet. Mal wondered if this whole shindig was some kind of elaborate Alliance Day practical joke, starting with a hazing and ending in a reunion of old comrades in arms. If so, it had been a little on the sadistic side, but all was well that ended well, right? "Hail, browncoats," he called down happily. As the echoes of his greeting faded away, the yelling stopped. Pins could have dropped in the cave and he would have heard them plink. Mal then realized the people were all glaring up at him, not a smile or a friendly wink from the lot. Swallowing down any other felicitous words he might have spoken, he felt the force of gazes brimming over with anger and hatred and was baffled by it. What had he done to warrant such a reaction? On the far side of the vault, he saw a raised wooden platform. Next to it stood what looked like the tower of an oil derrick, only about a 10th-scale version. It was, Mal thought, the remains of a drilling rig the miners would have used. It looked old. Somebody had prospected here once. Somebody had gone home empty-handed, doubtless having sunk some capital into the enterprise and bankrupted themselves. That would explain leaving equipment behind. No point throwing good money after bad. The rig's uppermost deck was raised about 6 feet from the floor. The familiar green and yellow flag of the Independence hung from the guardrail. Normally, the emblem would have been an encouraging, uplifting sight to Mal, telling him he was among friends. Now, he wasn't so sure he was. A chant began to rise from the crowd of people, low and scattered at first, then rapidly building so loud in the enclosed space that it hurt his ears, as well as his feelings.
"Traitor! Traitor!"
He blinked incredulously. Him? They were yelling it at him. "Settle down," a voice boomed over the crowd. "All of you, settle down." The brown coat men and women immediately stopped yelling at Mal and turned to face the platform, where a man had just stepped into view. Mal's jaw dropped as he recognized the speaker. "Hey, Mal. Welcome to the end of your life," said Toby Finn. Sixteen. The Planet Shadow, Long Ago. They were known as the Four Amigos. Their antics were legendary, at least amongst their peers, although amongst the inhabitants of their hometown, Seven Pines Pass, and most of the neighboring towns, they were considered tearaways and a liability. They drank. They got into and out of scrapes. They drank some more. They fell foul of the law from time to time. They drank even more. But they were essentially good-hearted, a bunch of kids on the cusp of adulthood who liked to mess around a bit and didn't much care about the consequences. There was Tobias Finn, the youngest of the four, known to his friends as Toby. Toby was pliant, going along with pretty much whatever the rest of them did, just glad to be in their company. This meant the others sometimes took advantage of him, like that time they persuaded him to shave all his hair off because they said girls found bald men attractive, or that time they dared him to steal Sheriff Bundy's 7-point star badge right off his lapel, which earned Toby a night in jail and a hefty fine. There was Jamie Adair, the oldest of them, who considered himself their leader. Jamie was the one who actually came up with the harebrained schemes which the others would either agree to carry out or not, depending how much booze they'd imbibed and how reckless their collective mood was. He was a clever kid who could have done well at school if he'd made an effort, but he preferred to dedicate his brain power to having fun, and it could be argued that that was a better use for it than learning algebra and slogging through dull-as-ditchwater literary classics from Earth that was. Then there was Jamie's sister, Ginny. Beautiful Ginny, she of the long, flowing, ash-blonde hair and the cute, up-tilted nose, with the smattering of freckles across the bridge like a map of some uncharted star system. Ginny, who was even cleverer than her brother, academically speaking, but possessed just as much of a wild streak. Jamie and Ginny were the despair of their parents, two unbroken colts that would not be tamed. Ma and Pa Adair longed for their offspring to make something of themselves, maybe leave Shadow where your life options were frankly limited, and relocate to one of the core planets. Out here on this mudball on the fringes of the Georgia system, there was nothing but arable farms and cattle ranches, and that was fine, but not necessarily suitable for anyone with smarts and a low boredom threshold. There were worlds where a young man or woman with the right grades and the right attitude could prosper, and maybe send a portion of that prosperity to the folks back home. The fourth member of the Four Amigos was a handsome devil with too long hair and a heck of a swagger for a kid scarcely out of his teens. The twinkle in his eye and the twist of his cocksure grin had won him the hearts of countless ladies in this county and the next, and gotten him into their beds, too. More than once, many times more, in fact, this incorrigible Romeo had been turfed out of a young woman's room by an irate father wielding a 12-gauge, and he had enough buckshot scars pepper in his backside to prove it. His name was Malcolm Reynolds, but he preferred just Mal. Mal's father was long gone, and his mother ran the family ranch, with 40 hands answering to her. Mrs. Reynolds had the lined, pinched face of a woman who was, if not thriving, then at least surviving in a life that never made things easy. The skin around her eyes was heavily wrinkled, and she had a permanent squint from staring so long across Shadow's prairie vistas. From time to time, she would call on her son to help out with work, shoeing, branding, rounding up, plowing, and so forth, and he would, but she knew she couldn't rely on him, and the older he got, the less reliable he became. Mal had too much else on his mind, namely chasing after girls and trouble. His personality seemed just too big for a small planet like this one to contain, and his feet were itchy. His destiny, Mrs. Reynolds couldn't help thinking, lay elsewhere. Out there in the verse. She hated the thought that he would leave Shadow, but knew the day would inevitably come. It was simply a question of how soon. Meanwhile, the Four Amigos' exploits just kept getting more and more outrageous. Perhaps the capstone of their careers in mischief came one especially hot and dusty summer, when Mortimer Ponticelli rustled several head of cattle off the Hendrickson's land, rounding the cows up as though they belonged to him and spiriting them off to his corral. Ponticelli even went to the effort of erasing the Hendrickson's brand off the cattle's flanks using dermal menders and replacing it with his own. It was out-and-out larceny, and everyone knew he was guilty of sin, but there was no proof, at least not as far as Sheriff Bundy was concerned. And anyway, more Ponticelli and Sheriff Bundy were best buddies. Bundy was actually married to one of the old geezer's many daughters, so the idea of the theft being investigated, let alone a prosecution being brought, was laughable. "I say we do something about it," Jamie Adair proposed one evening at the Silver Stirrup Saloon, the one and only drinking establishment in Seven Pines Pass. "Old man Ponticelli's been pulling crap like this since as long as anyone can remember, and it's about time someone set him to rights."
"And that's us, huh?" said Mal.
"You bet your ass it is. Ain't nobody gonna lift a finger against him, not while Bundy's in his pocket."
"In his pocket?" said Jenny Adair. "Sheriff Bundy kisses Ponticelli's ass so hard he's got permanent lip sores."
"But what?" Toby Finn asked.
"What can we do?"
"We can get those cows back," Jamie said. "We can go there tonight and just take them."
Toby looked dubious.
"Mort Ponticelli'll shoot you as soon as look at you. Don't know about you guys, but I value my life. I got more left to live of it than you."
"He won't kill us," Jamie said. "Wouldn't dare. Stealing's one thing, but murder? Not even Bundy could get him off that rap. He'd hang for sure, and he knows it."
"I don't know. Oh, come on, Toby," Ginny said, patting his cheek. "Don't be scared. I'll look after you."
Ginny was always affectionate towards him, and Toby preened at her touch. Though her junior by 3 years, anyone with eyes in their head could tell that he was madly in love with her. He had been since he was in fifth grade and she was in eighth. Now that he was at last old enough for the age difference not to seem such an unbridgeable gulf,
It was only a matter of time before he declared his feelings towards her. He had confided as much to Mal, and Mal had encouraged him to wait at least a little while more. You didn't just go telling girls you loved them, he had counseled Toby. If and only if you were completely sure that she was the one for you, did you fess up that you liked her deeply, rather than just in the carnal fashion. In the meantime, Mal's recommendation to Toby was that he should play the field, just as he himself was. Get some notches on his belt and then go for the big prize. You had to have a few go-rounds on the carousel first before you reached for the brass ring, after all. Otherwise, you'd grab for it and miss, and you'd have blown your shot, maybe for good. Mal gave this advice for reasons that were not entirely honorable and disinterested, because while he was indeed playing the field, treating himself to many a go-round on that metaphorical carousel, there was one girl he had set his sights on above all the rest, one who captivated him and whose presence never failed to thrill him, one who, in the fullness of time, when the moment was right, he would make his. And she was called Ginny Adair. Now, as Ginny worked her wiles on Toby, all the kid could do was blush and nod. Since when has Jamie ever led us astray? She added. I could count the times on my fingers, but I'd run out of hands, Toby replied. He scrubbed his head. My hair ain't ever felt the same since it grew back. Jamie chortled. Fair comment, but this time it ain't just some prank, Toby, old pal. This is serious. Nobody else is going to hold Ponticelli to account. The old bastard's been riding roughshod over this town for years. We can show him what we think about that, and if we do it right, he won't even know it was us. Several beers later, the plan, such as it was, had been finalized. They rode to the Ponticelli ranch on horseback, leaving their mounts tethered to a tree a mile out, and going the rest of the way on foot. Mal took point. He was generally agreed to be the best plainsman among them. He knew the lay of the land like nobody's business, having spent much of his childhood exploring and roaming the county. Growing up with no father at home to curb him and his mother too busy to tend to him, he'd been more or less a free agent. His attendance record at school had been patchy, verging on non-existent. He had invariably found the lure of the wilderness far stronger than the lure of the classroom. The night was moonless, but the starlight bright enough to see by as Mal led the other amigos along a back trail, down a narrow defile and across a dry creek bed. They moved in a wide circle around Mort Ponticelli's homestead so that they approached it from the rear, coming at it from the cover of a thicket of tall scrub and knotty cactus. The longhorn cows in the corral lowed nervously as they tiptoed closer.
Which ones are his and which the Hendricksons? Toby whispered. No way of telling, said Jamie.
But it makes no never mind. He poached a dozen, so we take a dozen, any dozen. That's fair and square.
Mal, Jamie, and Ginny slipped over the corral fence while Toby kept lookout. There were no lights on in any of the windows of the house, and just a single porch lamp winking on the veranda at the back. They'd brought rope, and carefully they fashioned halters and slipped them around the necks of a dozen cows, joining them together in pairs. Then Jamie unlatched the corral gate and opened it, nice and slow, and the others began leading the tethered cattle out two by two, like latter-day Noahs with a very singular notion of which species they were going to load aboard their ark. All was going smoothly until one of the final pair of cows got it into its head to complain. It began to make those anxious, hiccuping moos that signaled bovine distress, and Mal could only assume that it was one of Ponticelli's own livestock rather than any of the Hendricksons. It had been born and raised on this patch of land and didn't cotton to the idea of being removed. Ginny laid a hand on the cow's nose and murmured in its ear in order to quieten it. She had a way with cattle. They seemed to succumb to her charms as readily as any human male. The steer bowed its head almost as if in apology for having caused a fuss. Mal cast an anxious eye towards the house. No lights coming on, no one shouting. They'd gotten away with it. Then they hadn't. The back door burst open, and there on the veranda was Mort Ponticelli himself. He powered up a 1,000-lumen flashlight and swung the beam towards the corral. It was as bright as the sun, a ray of incandescent brilliance that dazzled all of the four amigos, freezing them in place.
You lousy varmints! Ponticelli yelled. I see you. You stop right there. I got a rifle and I ain't afraid to use it.
To underscore his point, he loosed off around. He aimed high deliberately, but not that high. The bullet zipped only a few feet above their heads, buzzing through the air like an angry and very lethal wasp. "Warning shot," Ponticelli said. "Next one goes right through one of you." They all looked at Jamie.
"What do we do?" Toby said.
Jamie's jaw was set firm. "What we came here to do." So saying, he thwacked the hindquarters of the nearest cow, which was not one of the dozen tied in pairs. It let out a shrill objection and charged for the open gate. The other cattle in the corral saw this as an invitation to stampede. All at once, the whole herd, which numbered close on 100, was making a beeline for the gate. As they thundered through, the roped pairs, which were already outside, started running ahead of them. Freedom beckoned, and they were all suddenly keen to seize the opportunity. It was pandemonium added to by Ponticelli, who began firing at the quartet of cattle thieves. Ducking low, Mal grabbed Ginny and hauled her towards the fence, using the fleeing cows as a shield. Jamie followed suit. They jumped the fence and kept running, joined now by Toby. Bullet after bullet zinged towards them, one coming so close to Mal that it struck the cow right next to him. The beast went cartwheeling over, 1,500 pounds of flailing legs and meaty body, and Mal had to fling himself to one side to avoid a collision. If the cow had rolled on him, he would have been flattened. "Son of a bitch!" Ponticelli hollered from the house. He was clearly very upset to have killed one of his own cattle. "You'll pay for that, you scumbags!" Mal rose just in time to see another cow plunging towards him, head lowered. He was simply an obstacle in its way, and it seemed to have no qualms about mowing him down. Ginny saved him, yanking him by the scruff of the neck. Together, they tumbled backwards onto the ground, and the cow lumbered past. They were back on their feet in no time, but Ponticelli had his range now. The next bullet he fired off came so close, Mal's hair was wafted by the pressure wave of its passing. He and Ginny sprinted after Jamie and Toby, trying to put distance between them and the house. But a further bullet made the ground directly in front of their feet erupt in a tiny plume of dust. Mal was certain that Ponticelli wasn't going to miss again. Desperately, he looked around for cover. There was nothing except the thicket, still 50 yards away. Then an idea occurred. Yet another cow was trundling towards them. Mal grabbed it by the horns and hoisted himself onto its back. It was a feat of athleticism he would never have attempted under any other circumstances, and might never be able to repeat, even if he wanted to. "Ginny, quick!" He reached out to her. She accelerated to keep pace with the cow. Hands clasped forearms, and Mal swung her up behind him. The cow lolloped onward. Even burdened with two passengers, it was barely slowed. Better yet, just as Mal had hoped, Ponticelli was loath to take a shot at them and risk losing another head of prime beef. He obviously valued his livestock higher than his desire to see malefactors get their just desserts. His impotent shouts from the veranda trailed after them, dwindling in volume. Mal and Ginny rode the cow for half a mile, by which time the stampede had begun to lose impetus. As they slowed, they looked around for Jamie and Toby and discovered that the two of them had copied their example and were also mounted on cows. All four exchanged grins of exhilaration and relief. "That was about the craziest thing ever, you bareback riding a steer," Jamie said to Mal. "Hadn't seen it with my own eyes, I'd never have believed it. But I thought, you know, if Mal Reynolds can manage it, so can I." "I fell off twice," said Toby. "Reckon my butt's gonna be black and blue for days, but it was worth it. We did it. We've gotten away with it." They dismounted and rounded up the roped-up cows, which they drove towards the spot where they'd left the horses. The remaining cows were at liberty to do as they wished, which probably meant traipsing back to the Ponticelli Corral eventually. Cows were homebodies that way. It was a short hop to the Hendrickson farm. Day was dawning as the four amigos led the cattle down the front drive, anticipating a hero's welcome. What they got was Anders Hendrickson emerging from the house in the company of Sheriff Bundy. Hendrickson looked perturbed, even frightened. Bundy had his thumbs hooked in his gun belt beneath his bulging gut. "Get down off of them horses," he ordered. The four amigos complied. None of them was armed, whereas Bundy had a pistol at his side and a hand hovering close to it. "Should have known it'd be you four," he said, shaking his head ruefully.
You think Mort Ponticelli didn't call me soon as his cattle were taken? You think I wouldn't know where they might be coming? Paid Anders here a visit first thing, and he swore to me it weren't nothing to do with him.
It ain't, Hendrickson said. Honest to God.
You didn't put these kids up to it, then?
No, Sheriff.
Might be as I believe you, Bundy said, seeing as how this is just the sort of stunt these four would pull without needing to be asked. It's you I particularly feel ashamed for, Jamie and Jenny Adair. You took a make something of yourselves, and you're just frittering it all away. Toby there's too young and callow to know better, while Mal Reynolds ain't been nothing but a disruptive influence since the day he was born and will likely continue to be such till the day he dies, which, the way he's gone, won't be that far in the future.
I have a problem with authority, Mal said. Not least when said authority is a big, fat, corrupt lawman with poor personal hygiene and a face that'd give a moose nightmares.
Bundy strode down the front steps and sauntered over to Mal, thrusting his face up close.
Say that again, boy, he growled.
Did I mention bad breath, too? Mal said. Because seriously, Sheriff, would it kill you to try a mint every once in a while?
The backhand slap came out of nowhere, hard enough to send Mal reeling to the ground. Clutching his face with one hand, the other clenched into a fist, Mal sprung up again. Bundy's gun, cocked and leveled with his face, halted him in his tracks.
Just try, Reynolds, he said. You just try, you insubordinate piece of Fei Wu. I won't regret blowing your brains out the back of your head. I'll even take pleasure going and telling your mama what I did and why I did it. Wonder if she'll cry or she'll just shrug like she knew you had it coming.
Mal ground his teeth. Jenny, who could see he was getting ready to hit Bundy come what may, put a restraining arm across his chest.
Don't, she said. Don't give him the excuse.
Mal backed down reluctantly. If it had been anyone but Jenny, he might not have heeded the advice.
We're sorry, Sheriff, said Jamie. It was high spirits is all. We didn't mean nothing by it. We'll return old man Ponticelli's cattle.
You better. They're also going to pay him reparations.
For what? Mal said.
Because I damn well say so, that's for what, Bundy snapped.
He named a figure that was equivalent to a month's salary for the average working stiff. He knew it was far more than the four amigos could readily scrounge up between them.
And I want it in his hands by tomorrow sundown, or else the four of you are going to be spending time in the county lockup, and I'm going to see to it myself that you get half rations and the most lice-ridden bedrolls we got.
It was Toby who got them the money. The Finns were well off by shadow standards, Liam Finn being a land surveyor and Marla Finn a practicing lawyer. Toby begged them for a handout, which they gave unwillingly. Every spare coin the four of them earned over the next few weeks went towards paying back the debt. In hindsight, they'd had a heck of an escapade, but it was a couple of months before the four amigos could truly laugh about it. And it was another couple of months before they plucked up the nerve to try anything even near as audacious again. During that time, Toby seemed to stand a little taller and carry himself with a little more confidence. Since he was the one who'd bailed them out, with parental assistance, but even so, he seemed to feel he had attained an elevated status within the group. He was no longer just the kid who'd tagged along. He was the equal of any of them. This clearly gave him the impression that he stood a better chance with Jenny now, and he stepped up his campaign to make her his girlfriend. And much to Mal's chagrin, it appeared to work. Jenny, at least, ceased treating Toby like a little brother. She no longer patted him or smiled at him with the same hint of condescension, but had gained a newfound respect for him, mirroring the newfound respect he had gained for himself. Now she and he would share confidences. Mal would catch them in unguarded moments with their heads together, chatting, sometimes giggling. It stuck in his craw. And yet he couldn't challenge Toby for Jenny's affections. Not now. It wouldn't have been right. They were the four amigos. They were as tight as a knot, as thick as thieves, bonded together by a shared love of roguery, famous for it, notorious. Mal couldn't let his jealousy jeopardize that. Could he?
Toby, Mal said softly. Toby Finn.
Toby, his one-time amigo, his another-time brother-in-arms. The man he would have gladly given his life for both before and during the war. Now, here he was up on the platform, and from what Mal could make out of his appearance, Toby was much changed. He was thin, positively emaciated, and was stooped over like a crook-backed octogenarian. His face was gaunt, and the mop of unruly ginger ringlets that Mal remembered was now a wispy cap, the few strands remaining atop his head coarse and kinked like copper wire. Toby used to catch holy hell in independent boot camp over those carroty curls of his. The other recruits called him Rusty and Little Orange. Seemed the post-war years, as for so many others, Mal himself included, had not been kind to Toby. But he was alive and here, and Mal was overjoyed. He cupped his hands and shouted, "Tobias! Tobias Finn! Toby!" His voice ricocheted off the surround of rock walls and ceiling. From the cavern floor, heads twisted in his direction. On the dais, Toby Finn stared up, his expression blank, unreadable. Mal was taken aback. Did Toby not recognize him? "Toby, it's me," he called. "Mal, you remember me, right?" His words were met with boos and hisses. Shocked, as though the catcalling had a physical force, Mal took a step backwards. Someone, a hatchet-faced woman with a lazy eye, grabbed his arm and held him still. The chorus of ill will rose in volume, buffeting him like body blows. "This is insane," Mal thought. "It's like I'm public enemy number one. What in tarnation is going on?" Then Toby raised his hands for silence. Gradually, the din died down. "Ladies, gentlemen, comrades, one and all," he said to the crowd. "It's been a long time coming, but I have done what you asked and what I promised." He thrust out his arm, pointing at Mal. "I have brought to face justice the man who conspired with the Alliance and stole victory from our grasp. I have brought you the traitor, Malcolm Reynolds." At the word traitor, which rolled off Toby's tongue with great emphasis, a fresh barrage of boos and shouted curses flew in Mal's direction. "String him up," someone yelled over the din. "String him up." It quickly became a new chant, not "traitor, traitor" now, but "String him up. String him up. String him up." Mal's brain strove to process this turn of events. On either side of him, his captors grinned and nodded to each other, as if seeing him humiliated was a rare and memorable treat. "This can't be right," he thought. "It ain't right. I must be asleep on the floor of my shuttle, still dopey from that gas Covington spritzed me with." But he wasn't. And now that his eyes had completely adjusted to the dim and shifting light, he picked out a couple of other faces below that he recognized. Other browncoats whom he had fought alongside in Serenity Valley. Sonia Zuburi, her raven hair prematurely streaked with white, looked like she wanted to take a bite out of him. Her husband David had his hand wrapped firmly around her arm and was holding her back. Mal had saved both of their lives at the risk of his own, advancing into the teeth of an enemy barrage, laying down covering fire so they could retreat from a burning barn. The expressions on their faces said his selfless act was long forgotten and had been replaced by something other than eternal gratitude. Sonia raised her fist and shook it at him as she chanted along with the others. David must have loosened his grip on her because she suddenly broke free, pushing away, shouldering between two burly men, one of whom stood aside to let her pass. As Sonia rushed towards the foot of the wall below the ledge, she bent down and picked up something from the floor. In the process, she sideswiped a fellow veteran, knocking him onto his back in the dirt. Her face contorted with rage, Sonia flung the rock at Mal. The men flanking him dodged the projectile, but Mal stood his ground, and he felt the breeze as it zinged past his left ear, missing him by millimeters. "Enough of that," Toby Finn shouted at the backs of the crowd. "Stand down, Sonia.
We aren't a Gorham rabble, we're soldiers. We will be disciplined about this.
Mal turned to the man standing beside him and said, What is it that you think I've done?
A blank stare was his only response, as if Mal had spoken in a foreign language. For one weird second, he wondered if the man was a robot with a malfunctioning neural cortex. The sense that this couldn't actually be happening, that this was all some feverish dream, welled up inside him again. Yet he couldn't deny the reality of his predicament. Not 10 minutes ago, his biggest problem was a full bladder. Death by lynch mob was looming larger as a source of concern. A peal of hurrahs rose up as a bald man scrambled up the front of Toby's platform with a coil of rope. He stopped near the top and held out his arm, dangling a hangman's noose from his fist. To roars of approval, he tied the end of the rope to the handrail and let the noose drop free. The crowd's frenzy bubbled up, soon on the verge of boiling over, and when it did, Mal was pretty sure they were going to find the courage to stretch his neck. Mob mentality. It could turn so quick. During the war, Mal had heard tales about non-combatant folks weeping at the sight of the browncoats arriving in their town to help them. Then dry those tears when it came clear that as hard as the independents fought, the town was going to fall to the Alliance. Heard that they blamed the men and women who had taken up arms to keep them free and turned on the exhausted soldiers, offering them to the Alliance commanders, even begging for them to be killed, as tears streamed down browncoats' war-worn faces. Sometimes folks went crazy with despair and did the killing themselves. They blamed us because they believed in us and we failed, Mal thought. Is that why I'm here?
String him up! String him up!
The crowd continued, surging to the foot of the wall. Tightly spaced gunshots rang out, sharp and deafening in the enclosed space. Armed men stepped forward, moving in front of the dais, their weapons shouldered and aimed at the spectators.
We will have order, Toby bellowed at them. We will follow the rule of law. The accused will get a fair trial and be judged by his peers. I know you're eager to see justice done, but we are not thugs. Malcolm Reynolds will get his day in court. And then we'll string him up, shouted someone in the crowd. Due process, Toby Finn reminded them sternly. He gestured to Mal. We are not criminals. We are not like him. A traitor is the worst kind of bad man there is. No allegiance to flag or brigade, no allegiance except to save his own stinking skin. Lock up the prisoner. Guard him well. We don't want nobody taking it on themselves to do anything unlawful. Do y'all hear me?
Toby, just listen to me for one moment, Mal said. Please.
Toby could scarcely hear him over the tumult. He beckoned for silence.
Fellow wants to say something. You got a moment, Mal. Speak.
I don't know what's gotten into you, Toby, Mal said, but I'm minded to think it's something we can work out. Let's sit down together over a drink, you and me, just like we used to at the Silver Stirrup back in the day, and talk it over. We were friends, still are to the best of my knowledge. I realize things on Shadow didn't end as we'd liked, especially where Ginny Adair's concerned. That is one of the real tragedies of my life. But I always thought we'd put it behind us. Leastways, that's how you always acted during the war. What's changed since?
What has changed, Mal? Came the reply. Why, only everything. I'm not the naive kid you used to know. I'm older, wiser. I've learned things.
Mal sensed he wasn't going to get anywhere with Toby, not in the time available, so he addressed himself to the crowd in general.
I don't understand what's happening. We're all browncoats here, am I right? We all fought in the war, fought the Alliance. I'm one of you. You must appreciate that. I've never done anything could warrant such treatment. Whatever crime you think it is I committed, and I would surely love someone to tell me, I am innocent.
Fine words, Toby said, from a lying Tama de Hundan.
He jabbed a finger in Mal's direction.
You know what you did. And all this time you've gotten away with it until now. Now, at last, your sins are catching up with you. How's it feel? Maybe it feels like all along you've known this day was coming, and now that it's arrived, you're glad, almost relieved. Your life of skulking around, of passing for honorable, is at an end. You can finally face up to who you really are.
Baying cries rose up as Mal shouted, "That's bullcrap, Toby. If anyone's guilty of being dishonorable, it's you with this here three-ring circus of yours. You got this bunch of morons all whipped up into a lather with your pandering and your speechifying, but you're the one who's lying, and they're going to realize it sooner or later. And then where will you be, huh?"
He realized he wasn't helping his case any, insulting Toby and the other browncoat veterans, but he was darned if he was going to let them make him their patsy or scapegoat or whatever it was they wanted him to be. He wasn't going down without a fight, and for the time being, at least, his best and only weapons were words. Sure enough, the crowd went berserk, stomping and hollering. They were out for blood, his blood, and Toby didn't hesitate to egg them on.
"Listen to him," he said. "That's how little he thinks of you. That's the attitude of a man who'd sell out his brothers and sisters. Get him out of here. I want him out of my sight."
A barrage of hate crashed down on Mal as the guards formed a huddle around him and herded him back down the tunnel, led by the hatchet-faced woman with the lazy eye. His legs were wobbly, his wrists chafed in their bonds. Everything that didn't throb ached, and everything that didn't ache throbbed. He felt about 100 years old. This time, when they reached the fork in the tunnel, they took the other branch, away from the shouting and the fury. Away from Toby Finn, one of his best friends growing up on Shadow, who, by some inexplicable twist of fate, planned to be his executioner. In the light of the torches, the hatchet-faced woman stopped. She turned towards the wall on the right, yanking open a rusted wire mesh door. The hinges squealed. Hatchet-face gestured impatiently at the opening. Mal's escorts bunched in tight around him like they expected him to make a run for it, like they hoped he would, so they could beat him down. His lizard brain told him to do just that. Make your Goram play, see what it gets you. He knew if he walked through that opening, he was never going to come out again. Might as well make a stand here and now, even if it only hastened the inevitable. As the guards shuffled Mal forward, time seemed to slow. Details of his surroundings became magnified, larger than life. Water trickled down one of the tunnel walls, drop by drop, disappearing into a dark puddle of muck. A moth circled a burning torch, flirting with fiery death. Something made a little screechy noise farther down the tunnel in the darkness. A bat, maybe, hanging upside down, trying to fall back to sleep. Mal's heart pounded to a funereal cadence, the kind where widows in black veils walk lead-footed behind the caisson, the dead soldier's boots dangling backwards from the stirrups of his horse. Damn, he was in such strange, ungodly trouble. As they reached the doorway in the wall, he slid his glance into the dim hole where they planned to plant him. It must have been a storeroom of some kind. Nothing on the floor, no straw for a bed, nor a blanket to cover himself. Just dirt and rock. Behind him, he could sense the mass of the guards blocking his way out. Once more, his very soul protested, screaming at him to save himself, to do something. No. It would make more sense to be compliant, do what they wanted him to, bide his time. That would give him the leisure to think of a way out of this situation. So a calmer portion of his mind advocated. But then adrenaline took over. A surge of fight or flight, an impulse whose dictates were impossible to refuse. There was no decision to act. It just happened of its own accord, like water flowing downhill. Mal spun on his heel, bent low, and charged the nearest guard, shoulder striking the man mid-chest and knocking him off balance and backward. As hands reached for Mal, he used the space he'd created, lashing out with his right boot. Contact as he kicked the man between the legs. Without his arms free to counterbalance him, the kick was a little off-center,
a little too far back to cause maximum pain, but it was still enough to elicit a squeal and a gasp. Mal spun again, one complete turn, building momentum. The man was on his knees, mouth gaping, so Mal didn't have to kick high to hit him in the jaw. He felt the impact all the way to his hip joint. It felt good. Someone in front of him grabbed his shoulders and Mal lunged forward, using his head as a battering ram, driving the crown of it into the other's midriff. The hands released him. Mal whirled around, then charged the person blocking the doorway, Hatchet Face herself. Before he could reach her, fists from all sides, all angles, rained down on him, slamming into his solar plexus, connecting with his jaw, his kidneys. Mal staggered forward under the onslaught, fell to his knees in the dirt, then toppled forward. A crushing weight came down on his back, grinding his face deeper into the soft dirt. He couldn't breathe. He grunted. It was the only noise he could make as the fist pounding continued. Black washes of pain filled his mouth as the weight suddenly came off, and he was dragged backwards by his legs into the storeroom, which was clearly going to serve as a holding cell. Angry shouts played counterpoint to the toe caps battering his sides. Then hoarse laughter as the door clanged shut with the sudden force of a coffin lid. A bolt clanked as it was shot home. "Oh, God, that was dumb," Mal chastised himself. "Why'd I go and do that?" The man he had so soundly drop-kicked pressed his bruised mouth to the rusted mesh of the metal door. "You're gonna die," he said to Mal, his voice dripping with relish just as his split lip dripped with blood. "And it's gonna be slow. Real slow." "And don't get to thinking anyone's coming to rescue you, neither," Hatchet Face crowed. "Apparently you captain a Firefly these days and have a crew. Well, we took you in your own shuttle from Gilder's and made it look as though you were piloting it. And the reason for that is nobody'll suspect otherwise, not even your people. They'll just assume, being the yellow belly turncoat you are, you lit out on them, and they won't be bothered none to go after you." "If you believe that," Mal said, "then you have sorely underestimated my crew. They ain't easily fooled. They're coming for me. I know it in my bones. And woe betide you when they get here, darling, because they'll be pissed and they will seriously mess up your day." "Sure, sure," said Hatchet Face. "Even if that's the case, they're bound to be too late. How long do you think you've got? We're just waiting on a couple more folks to show. Soon as they arrive, and it'll be any moment now, the trial will begin, and rest assured, it won't be a long trial. Your life can be measured in hours, Reynolds. Savor what time you have left, because it ain't much at all." 18. The room was large, with an artificial rock waterfall that towered at least 15 feet high. The water spilled into a tiled pond. Golden koi fish swam lazily beneath lily pads, now and then mouthing the surface. Opposite lay a big rectangular picture window bordered by gleaming swords and battle axes. The view was of a particularly beautiful section of Persephone, where large swaths of cultivated gardens hung between the silvery skyrises. A wealthy district. If the docks were hell, this was heaven. Miko Wong, having ushered Book into the room and allowed him a moment or two to admire his surroundings, gestured for him to take a seat in an ornate, overstuffed chair. He picked up a remote off a small table and clicked on a holographic fireplace next to the chair. Then he instructed a servant, a man dressed in a butler's brass-buttoned livery, to fetch drinks. The butler filled two gold-hued cups from a matching decanter and handed one to Book and the other to Wong before gliding back over to a corner and stationing himself there, fixing his gaze in a dispassionate middle-distance stare. Book lowered himself into the chair and sniffed the liquid. He had anticipated wine, which he would have had to decline, but to his delight found that he was drinking clean, fresh water. Cooled to a perfect chilliness, it was nectar on his tongue, and went a long way to dispelling the ache in his head from the blows he had received at the hands of Charlie Dunwoody and company. Wong sat opposite. The years had been kind to the former commander of the Alliance Anti-Terrorism Division.
Taller than Book, his spine was ramrod straight. He was tanned and fit. His once black hair, now a sleek silvery gray instead of plain white like Book's. He was wearing black trousers and a slate-colored shirt, appearing almost militaristic. "So," he said, "Dariel Book got rolled. Who would have thought? You, of all people." Book smiled sheepishly. "Maybe I'm losing my edge." "I doubt it. What happened?"
"I offered charity to a man who decided I was being too stingy." Book shrugged. "As they say, no good deed goes unpunished."
"Well, you were certainly punished."
"I'd like to say I had the situation under control, but clearly you did not. And you, equally clearly, have not lost your edge," Book said. "That was some fancy footwork for an old man."
"I keep in shape," Wong said. "I have a dojo on the premises and spar practically every day with my trainer. Just because I'm retired doesn't mean I have to atrophy. Also, I had the element of surprise. Those fellows didn't see me coming until it was too late to do them any good."
"A dojo? A room like this? A house this size? Staff?"
Book motioned at the butler, who acted oblivious, as though he was not even present in the room.
"You're doing pretty well for yourself, Mika."
"Especially," he didn't say, "for a man living on a military pension. For sure, the commander of an entire department would receive a decent annuity and plenty of perks, but enough to afford this kind of lifestyle? Not likely." "I get by," Wong said. "How about you? Still sequestered away at Southdown?"
"I left the Abbey a few months back. Thought I'd walk in the world a while."
"Why?" Wong crossed his legs and sipped from his glass. "I avoid it as much as possible."
"I find I still have things to do. A life of contemplation and prayer provides one with a peace that passeth all understanding, but our universe is far from peaceful. It seems self-indulgent to live apart when so many are in need of help.
You always were a bit of a radical.
Or a pragmatist. We raise ourselves up by lifting others."
"You're full of pithy quotes." Wong smiled, but his gaze was sharp, brittle, assessing. "It's been a long time," he added. "You'll have to catch me up."
"Quid pro quo," Book returned. "I never dreamed you'd retire."
"Forced out."
Wong's tone was rueful and not a little resentful.
"New guidelines for mandatory retirement. They thought I was past it."
"That's a shame," Book said. "Shepherds don't retire, we just redefine our vocations."
As Book took another swallow of water, he studied Wong. When he had known him before, the commander had been all spit and polish, a minimalist who traveled light. The Mika Wong of the past would have scoffed at the luxury in which the two of them now sat, and would have questioned the method by which such obvious wealth had been acquired if he were investigating someone else. He might well have accused a retired Alliance officer who lived like this of illegal practices. And Book recalled the waitress in the Seawolf saying as much about him. Forcing businesses to pay for protection? Could such a thing be true?
"At any rate," he said,